Chafalfam and Aleph, and we're continuing our discussion about David HaMelech. You remember from yesterday that the Gemara quotes a pasuk in Malachim to prove that David HaMelech was married to six wives. There were some issues here, and we'll have some more issues today. The issue that we had yesterday was, where is Michal? Because David married the daughter of Shaul, and her name does not appear on this list. And assuming this is an exhaustive list, why is Michal omitted from this list? Now that has implications as far as the issue of our Mishnah. How many women is the king allowed to marry? Because if David was married to seven women, and not just to six, if we add Michal to the list, then we multiply that number seven by three, and we come up with 21. So maybe we'll get a chance to review some of that today. But that was our discussion of yesterday. And the final conclusion was that Michal is actually on this list of six wives, because although the Torah hides it and uses a different name and an acronym for Michal, and she's called the Egla, and we see that the word Egla throughout Tanakh means chavivus. It means a certain special relationship, a singular relationship. So David had a singular relationship amongst all his wives with Michal, particularly with Michal, and that's why the Torah, the Tanakh, gave her the name Egla. In any event, the question is, how do we justify the fact that in this list of six wives, and Egla now is Michal, all of these six are listed as having children? They were all mothers of sons. In the case of Michal, for example, she was the son of Yisra'am. And yet we know that Michal was unfortunately punished and she didn't have any children. So the Gemara offers two suggestions. Either she didn't have children while she was alive, she had her only single child, Yisra'am, when she died. In other words, at childbirth she died. Or alternatively, the curse that she received, not to have any children, that would take place at a later period of time. There are two historical period times in David's married life. There's what we call the Chevron period of time, and then there's the Yerushalayim period of time. And the six wives that are listed here in Tanakh, the mothers of six of David's children, six of his sons, they gave birth to those sons during the Chevron period of time. The later period of time is what we call the Yerushalayim period of time. And that's the period of time in which David HaMelech was able to free the Aron Kodesh, the Aron Shtei Luchos HaBris that was taken captive by the Plishtim. And there the Tanakh records an episode in which David HaMelech was Mefazes Umecharker Lifnei HaAron. During this wonderful celebration, this whole ritual, when they brought the Aron back to Yerushalayim, David was dancing in a wild sort of way in front of the Aron, out of a sense of genuine simcha. And Michal Bas Shaul was watching this, and she saw that many other women and many other people were watching. This was in the public eye, and she thought that this was insulting to Malchus, to the enterprise of kingship. This is not behooving of a way a king should act publicly. And David HaMelech goes out and he confronts her. She says, "Ma nichbar hayom melech b'Yisrael, asher nigla hayom li'enei imhos avodav kigolos." And he goes, "Achar ha-reikim." Reikim means he appears like one of the people who are empty. This is not the way a king should behave. And David comes back and he gives a tochacha. As a result of her, in a sense, undermining or insulting David, she was given the punishment that she would not have a vlad from that moment on, from the enterprise, from that encounter at the Aron on the way to Yerushalayim. From that period of and on, she would have no children, and she was punished. But she did have a son earlier in the marriage with David, before that episode, and that took place in Chevron. Now, at the end of the day, right now, we're assuming that David was married to how many women?
Six.
So that seems to be the magic number. We're going to multiply 6 times 3 and derive the maximum number of wives that a king is allowed to marry. And that mathematics is based on a pasuk that says that Nasan Anavi comes out to David and he says to him, "Ma'at Nashim Elu Yeshlecha, if you don't have enough wives, you want to take more. Osifa Lecha Od Nashim Kahena V'Kahena. Kahena means double, so we have another 6. And V'Kahena means another 6. So we have the 6 wives plus Kahena, another 6, and another 6 all told, 18. Again, all this is premised on the assumption that David HaMelech was married to 6 wives. So what we're up to now is the word V'Haksiv. So let's turn to Daf Chaf Aleph Amud Aleph, and we'll see if we can all find the place for the new day. We're in the wide lines towards the second half of the page, and the V'Haksiv is in the middle of a line that starts with the word Masa. So the first word in the line should be Masa. I would assume that that's midway down the wide lines, or halfway up from the bottom of the page on the wide line section. And if you count up from the bottom of the page, approximately, shall we say, 12 lines of just estimating, you'll see the word Masa. And if you move with your finger across that line, you should see the word V'Haksiv. And that's where we got up to yesterday. Now the Gemara quotes a problematic pasuk in Sefer Shmuel Beis, because there it says, V'yikach David od pilagshim v'noshim b'Yerushalayim. Then in fact, David HaMelech married other women. These were women that fell into one of two categories, and he married the women from both categories. One was Pilakshim, we'll see what that means, and the other was Noshim. In any event, it seems clear that in addition to the wives that he married in Chevron, David HaMelech took many other wives. And therefore, when we darsh in the Pasuk Kahena V'Kahena, we should be multiplying not by the number 6, but by some higher number. Again, exactly what that number is, we don't know. But at this point, the Gemara is very perplexed. How could you assume that David HaMelech only married 6 wives? So one of the super commentaries amongst the Achronim on Masechta Sanhedrin is the Toras Chaim. I think we've had more than one occasion in which we quoted the Toras Chaim. And the Toras Chaim here is somewhat perplexed. He doesn't understand what bothers the Gemara here. V'haksiv v'yikach David od pilagshim v'noshim b'Yerushalayim. Why not assume that once Nasan HaNavi gave David HaMelech the license, he gave him the okay to marry up to 18 wives, that this pasuk is revealing to us, is recording the fact that David HaMelech took advantage of that license, and he indeed implemented what Nasan HaNavi gave him rishus to do, and he married a whole bunch of women up to, but not beyond, the number 18. Why does the fact that David HaMelech took other wives in Yerushalayim disprove our thesis that a king is allowed up to, but not beyond, 18 women? It could be that David HaMelech was now filling in the gap between 6, or shall we say 7, and 18. And these were the wives. So that Nasan HaNavi says to him, Osifa lecha kahena v'kahena, which means that now you could marry other wives. And in addition to the 6 wives that he was married to at the time that Nasan gave him that license, he now married other wives. And these would make up the number, shall we say, the increment or the differential between 7 and 18. Above 6, the 7th wife, and then all the way up to 18. That's the kash of the Toras Chaim. He really doesn't understand why the Gemara is bothered by this. Maybe the other wives that he took were taken by David HaMelech after he had this permission from Nasan HaNavi that he's allowed to marry above 6 wives. He can go as high as 18 wives. Why is the Gemara so perplexed about this. So let's just let's just see the Gemara's answer, which I think is really the Taurus Chaim's answer. And the Gemara says, "Lemalui, lemaloye, shmonasre." That Enochinami, these additional wives were made up to make up the difference between 6 and 18, that increment, which is exactly what we understood from the Taurus Chaim. That doesn't mean that Taurus Chaim shouldn't be bothered here. The Taurus Chaim wants to know why the Gemara needs to come on to this teretz. Why wasn't it Muvan Me'elav? It should have been understood from the get-go. So let me just read to you a line or two from the Taurus Chaim, as quoted here in the footnote, in the Masifta. He says the following, V'tiretz ha-Gemara, afsha posig nichtav mitchila, b'emes lo nosa noshim elu ela achar ma'ase bat sheva, ulekacham lemale minyan ha-shmonas ha-miyutaras. The Taurus Chaim says that what the Gemara is vacillating back and forth is about the chronological sequence. You get the impression that what happens here is earlier, right? Let's see what we can figure out. The pasuk of Nosan Anavi, which we saw in Ma'at, etc., Vosifel Chokeina Kahena, that appears in the 12th chapter of Shmuel Beis. This pasuk that the Gemara is quoting here, Vayikach David Od Pilakshim Venoshim Yerushalayim, appears in the 5th chapter of Shmuel Beis, a full 7 chapters earlier. And therefore the Gemara was assuming that this pasuk is describing events that took place before his meeting, his encounter 7 chapters later with Nosan HaNavi, when Nosan gives him license. So that Nosan's license of Kohenah v'Kohenah should be interpreted in the light of the number of wives that he was already married to at the time that Nosan encountered him in Chevron. But already in Yerushalayim earlier, he had taken more wives. So what the Gemara answers is that we're going to apply the principle called Ein Mukdam Umiyuchar Batorah. And what we're going to say is that even though this pasuk appears in a later chapter, it's describing event. I'm sorry. Even though this pasuk appears in an earlier chapter, in the 5th chapter of Shmuel Beis, which is way before the chapter that records Nosan HaNavi's licensed him, nevertheless, the events that are recorded here in the 5th chapter actually took place sequentially after his license with Nosan HaNavi. So that in the Habamina, the Gemara thought, let's read the Psukim Kisidrom, and let's read them in sequence the way they appear in the Tanakh. And therefore we have every right to assume that David was married to many other women besides that 6. And that would mean that we have to reinterpret Nosan HaNavi, Kohen of a Kohena, in light of a larger number, a number that goes way beyond 6. And the Gemara answers no. That in fact what the Pasuk is recording is the last period of time in David's life, which is the second Yerushalayim, not the first Yerushalayim before he gets to Hebron, but the second Yerushalayim, and that's when he takes these women, and he's doing so because he had the license from Nosan to go beyond the number 6, and now he's making up the difference between 6 and 18. Did I manage to confuse you? I hope I didn't. I tried not to. Again, I was just trying to understand, and that's the Taurus Chaim, to analyze the Hamamina here and the Maskana, what the Gemara was vacillating about. The Gemara thought in the Hamamina that these wives were married by David before he met with Nosan HaNavi in Hebron, in the first period of his life in Yerushalayim. And the Gemara answers no, that even though this pasuk appears earlier in the sequence of Psukim, before he encounters Nosan, nevertheless the Tanakh here is recording something that took place later down the line. Now the Gemara takes a little bit of a digression. That we've quoted the pasuk that David HaMelech married both Pilakshim and Noshim. Obviously these are two categories. And as you know, 1/6 of Shas is called Seder Noshim. And the subject matter of that Seder is what we call Ishus. Ishus is the halachic relationship between a man and a woman. And the question is, are there two different categories within Ishus? And that's what the Gemara is analyzing. My Noshim, Umay Pilagshim. It sounds like these are two different categories of marriage relationships. Om Rav Yehuda Marav, what's the difference between the two? Noshim, this is what we call full-fledged Ishus, is Biksuba Ubikidushin. So far I'm okay. I understand what's going on until this point. When a man marries a woman, he gives her kesef, shtar, or bia. Those are the three methods by which he achieves what? Kiddushin, and he generates ishus. However, in addition to kesef kiddushin, if he marries her with kesef, which is our minhag today that a man gives a woman a ring, which is called shava kesef, he also has to give her a ksuba. And as you know, a ksuba is an additional payment. It's a conditional payment. It's not an absolute automatic payment. That in the event that he divorces her, or if he dies, she collects a sum, let's say if it's a first marriage for her, of 200 zuz, which is an awesome sum of money. Or in event that she was married once before, and this is a second marriage, then she collects mea zuz, which is half that amount. And that's the ksuba. Now the Gemara establishes in one particular Masechta about the ksuba, which Masechta is that? You can already guess. Right? Masechta Ksubas. The Gemara establishes that if a man marries a woman and he doesn't write a ksuba, he's not allowed to live with her. So I advise every single one of you to make sure that your wives, each wife respectively, is holding on to a ksuba. A lot of women, and I don't blame the women, but it's a reality, they're not so careful with the ksuba. And if you tap a woman on the back and ask her, where's your ksuba? She'll say, oh, I don't know. I don't know where I put it. Maybe I locked it up somewhere, maybe I didn't. And the Gemara says that you're not allowed to live with a woman without a ksuba. So the completion of the ishus relationship is clinched by the ksuba. Now, whether that's a doraisa halacha or a drabanan halacha, you have to learn mesech the ksubas. So we're not going to do that. Let's assume, for argument's sake, that ksuba is doraisa. And that clinches the issue. So you have Kesef Shtar Bia, which is the first stage, which is Kiddushin. Then he takes her into the Chuppah. And at the Chuppah, when he clinches the Nisuin, he gives her a Ksuba. That's a document that she holds. And she has to hold on to that document. And once he delivers that document into her hands, and she makes a Kinyan on the Ksuba, at that point the marriage relationship is complete. That's called Nashim. That's called Ishus. That's classic. But what is Pilagshim? Pilagshim obviously is the plural of the word Pilegesh. Now here, we're about to embark upon some very treacherous territory, you know, some choppy waters. Because what we're about to read now is the particular girsa of some Rishonim, but certainly not all Rishonim. Okay, so let's learn this Gemara. We'll read this Gemara according to the way it's printed in our Talmud Bavli, and that reflects the Shita of many, many Rishonim. And that is that Pilagshim below Ksuba ubelo Kiddushin. Now this is strange, because if you read the Gemara at straightforward value, you know, at how should we say, surface level, a Pilegesh has nothing. She has no Ksuba, she has no Kiddushin. So why do we call that Ishus? You know, why is that called a category of a wife? What we're presuming now that she has to have a total singular dedication and loyalty to her husband. She's not allowed to live with another man until there's a termination of that relationship, that Ishus is broken up. But what is the nature of that Ishus that A, allows her to have an intimate relationship, a marriage relationship with her husband, and B, which generates a prohibition that no one else is allowed to have a relationship with her? again, until this relationship is terminated. And then we have to ask a question, how do you terminate that relationship? So, but first, we're going to ask the question not about termination, but creation. How do you create this relationship? What is it that clinches and generates ishus in a case of a pilegish? So let's begin with the Rambam Shita. The Rambam Shita is that Pilegesh is miyuchedes lo, which means that he designates this woman, and she accepts that designation, for him, exclusively for his own relationship. The Rambam goes on to say that that creates a kinyan, and a pilegesh is knuya labaila. Then the Rambam goes on and adds another element, and he says that as a result of that kinyan, he, the husband, is allowed to live with her. Then the Rambam adds another element into the equation. As a result of that kinyan, not only is he allowed to live with her, but she's not allowed to have a relationship with any other man. So far, it looks very, very similar to Ishus. Because if you ask me to break down the elements of Ishus, I would say that Ishus, in a case of Noshim, of an Ishus Ish, is number one, that she is miucheres to him. Number two, he has a kinyan on her. No one else is allowed to have a relationship, but he and only he is allowed to have a relationship with. Well, all that, the Rambam checks off the entire list with regard to Pilegesh. So what is the difference between a married woman and a Pilegesh? So the Rambam says the following, that in the case of Pilegesh, you don't need Kesef, you don't need Shtar, you don't need Bia, none of the formal methods of Kinyan are required. All you need is Yichud. That means all you need is to designate this woman for you to the exclusion of everyone else. You do not give her Kiddushin, neither Kesef, Shtar, nor Bia, nor do you give her Ksuba. And the word Pilegesh itself comes from the Aramaic word polig. Now you and I think that polig means to disagree. Well, that's true, but that's not really the literal translation of the word polig. What does polig mean? To divide. When you divide something, it's called pligi or plugta. A plugta is a division. Again, we use it to refer to a division of opinions in a case of a controversy, but the real McCoy meaning of the, etymologically of the word of polyg or pligi or plugta is a division. And when you divide something, unless we know otherwise, you divide it in two halves. And a pilegesh is half of ishus. Now what does that mean, half of ishus? So you could talk about a half of a whole in quantitative terms or in qualitative terms. And I think in this case of Pilegesh, both are correct. First, let's talk about quantity. In quantity, what do I mean by quantity? Something that you could measure. In the case of an Ishus Ish, a full-fledged Ishus, if a man, other than her husband, has a relationship with her, that's Gili Arayis, that's a Chiyuv Misa, it's a capital crime. In the case of Pilegesh, there is no punishment for the man who has a relationship with her. Perhaps we would give him Malkus, but even that Malkus is not the real 39 lashes. It's only a kind of a rabbinic punishment. So in that sense, you could really understand that even in terms of quantity, she is half of a wife. But now we get to quality. In terms of quality, the ishus is of a totally different sort. Qualitatively, it's a different ishus. For example, a pilegesh does not need a get. As soon as he decides to terminate that relationship, he sends her out, and she's a free woman. Number two, if, let's say, he dies without any children, she does not fall for yibum. There's no mitzvah of yibum in the case of a pilegesh. All of this is indicative of the fact that a pilegesh is qualitatively different than ishus. It's not the real ishus.
Sounds like a concubine almost.
Well, again, the English translation is concubine. I'm trying like the Dickens to avoid that word. Because whenever you translate a halachic term into English, you don't know what you're batting about. You know, because the word concubine, I don't know, you can look up Merriam-Webster Dictionary, you can look up here, there, and elsewhere. it's not going to help you. It's just going to confuse you. Now, a pilegesh, we said before, according to the Rambam, is miyuchedes lo, right? He has yichud. He designates her for him, which means that she is designated to have this intimate relationship of a husband and wife. And this, even in the absence of real quality ishus, is not full-fledged ishus, as we gave all the differences before. However, this is wonderful according to our text in the Gemara, and that's the Rambam. Rashi, in his Perish al HaTorah, we should really open this up if we can find the Chumash Breishis, maybe somewhere with Rashi. Maybe, Steve, you can find one here. If you could do me a favor, Ruvein, maybe you could open up to Breishis Chaf Hei 25, verse 6. Do you remember that? 25:6. Rashi says that the difference between a Pelegesh and an Isha, an Eshes Ish, is only with regard to Ksuba. He had a different girsa in our Gemara. According to Rashi, the text in our Gemara should say Pelegesh below Ksuba, period. Erase the two words below Kiddushin. In other words, according to Rashi, even in the case of Pelegesh, there was Kiddushin. Which means that according to Rashi Shita, she is basically a full-fledged Eishes Ish. The only thing she's missing is what? A Ksuba, which means that if he divorces her after his death, she does not collect the Ksuba. According to Rashi Shita, all other laws of Ishus would apply to a Pelegesh identically to the way they apply to a full-fledged Eishes Ish. It means that she would fall for Yibum if he dies without children. She would need a get to break up the, if somebody had a relationship with her, you'd be Chayav Misa, because she is an Eishes Ish. You begin to see that Rashi's understanding of Pelegesh is radically different than the Rambam's definition of Pelegesh. Ruven, able to find that Rashi? Rashi in Chaf Hei Vav. See if you can find such a Rashi that talks about Pelegesh.
Pilagshim below ketubah.
Do you see that? Nashim b'ketubah, pilagshim below ketubah. Rashi indicates that the entire difference between nashim and pilagshim is the ketubah. The pilagish doesn't get a ketubah. Now let me ask you a question. We said that a king is allowed to marry up to what? 18 wives. Would pilagshim be included in that minyan? Well, let's go quick to Rashi. Rashi says that a Pelegesh is exactly the same as an Eishes Ish. The only difference is she doesn't have a Ksuba. There's no reason why the absence of a Ksuba should make any difference, because fundamentally, with regard to 99.9% of the laws, she, the Pelegesh, has the same status as an Eishes Ish. There was Kesef, Shtar, or Kiddushin. Okay, she doesn't collect a Ksuba. Fine. She agreed to marry him without a Ksuba. That makes her a Pelegesh. So according to Rashi, I would certainly be inclined to think that when the Torah, when the Tanakh testifies that Vayikach David owed Pilagshim v'noshim, that means that those Pilagshim would be part of the making up of the number 18. However, according to the Rambam, I don't know whether Pelegesh should be included in this minyan, because the Rambam says that she doesn't have Kesef, Shtar, or Bia. Namely, no formal Maisa Kiddush. The Rambam only has Yichud, that he designates her. But I'm inclined to think that even the Rambam would agree that Pelegesh should be counted amongst the 18 women. Why is that? Because again, the Rambam says that all the elements that make up Ishus apply even to Pelegesh. Number one, the Rambam says that she has a kin, he has a kinyan in her. She's knuya lo. Number two, the Rambam says she's muteres lo. Number three, she's asura l'kol ha'olam. Now again, the severity of the violation, if let's say she would have an illicit relationship with another man, is on a whole different level according to the Rambam. So it's not the full-fledged Ishus. But nevertheless, it is a marriage relationship according to the Rambam. Haraya, all the elements of Kinyan, of Isur, of Heter, Isur to the world, Heter to him, they all apply. You check them all off according to the Rambam. Now the Ravid, he was the one who said that the word Pilegesh comes from the word Plug, which means half, and she's half of a wife. So according to the Ravid, it could be that the Pilagshim, since they're only halfway, maybe they wouldn't be counted. Or maybe every two Pilagshim should count as one. That was a joke, but nobody laughed. So I'll laugh myself. My father used to laugh at his own jokes. Yeah, anyway.
I have a question on later on about Hagar. It seems like Rashi goes out of his way to say that Hagar did not have relations after she was sent out, when she came back to him as Keturah. What would be the nafkamina there? If she had relations, she would not have been able to have that?
I don't know. Not sure. I didn't see the Rashi. So you know what, Reuven, let's hold off with this Rashi. If you don't mind, I'll look at it inside. It's, you know, you caught me off guard over here. You know, threw me a little bit of a curveball. So again, Amar Rav Yudah Marav, Nashim b'ksuba u'b'kiddushin, Pilagshim b'lo ksuba u'b'lo kiddushin. Okay. Now if I were to ask you how many children David HaMelech fathered, you would probably say somewhere between 6, maybe if you double it, you get to 12. Amar Rav Yudah Marav, Arbamios Yeladim LeDavid. David was the father of 400 Yeladim. Yeladim means usually males, you know, sons. Now, I have a lot of problems with this Gemara. You know, we're going to see the Mefarshim here that also have, thank God, they can empathize with my issues here. It's pretty mind-boggling to think that one man was the father of 400 children. But in any event, let's first take the Gemara literally, at simple face value. David HaMelech took maximum 18 wives. How was he able to have 400 sons from 18 wives? The numbers just don't add up. So Rabbi Yehuda says in the name of Rav Vekulon, where did he get these 400 sons? B'nei Yefas Toar Hayu. Now, let's understand that normally a Jewish man is not allowed to have a relationship with a non-Jewish woman. And that's a pretty severe violation. It's called Kanoim Pogimbo, which means that if Beis Din doesn't give him punishment, then the Kanoim could come and actually put him to death. His official punishment for having a relationship with a non-Jewish woman is called Kareis Midivrei Kabbalah. Okay, that's also pretty severe. However, there's one scenario, one situation in which the Torah allows a Jewish man to have a relationship with a non-Jewish woman, what we call shiksa. And what's that? Yefas Torah, in a milchama situation. When a man goes out to war, to battle, and let's say they take women as captives from the non-Jewish nations, then if she finds favor in his eyes and he's, shall we say, overwhelmed by his passion, the Torah says that he's allowed to have relations with her. The Gemara tells us this is because Lo Dibra Torah El Kneged Yetzer Hara. The Torah recognized that in certain situations the power of the evil inclination is so great that man cannot withstand. And especially when a man goes out to war and all that's involved in war, it just creates an emotional havoc. And when he sees this woman who's beautiful, he wants to have a relationship with her. She's not Jewish. And the Gemara tells us in Masechet Kiddushin that if the Torah wouldn't have allowed him to have this relationship, beheter, he would have had this relationship, the Isur. We can predict that he would not be able to overstand, to overcome the Yetzer Hara. Now, the Gemara tells us another sociological factor. that the daughters of the Goyim, and we know this from Moab, but this was apparently quite popular of a method, the daughters of the Goyim, when they went out to battle, they would dress up to kill, as we would say, in a very alluring sort of way. And they were hoping that the Jewish soldiers would have a relationship with them in such a way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu would be so angry with the Jewish people that he would chas v'shalom bring about their defeat. So once again, the Gemara establishes that because of this very unique, sensitive situation, the Torah allowed him to have this relationship. But here's where we get to the main issue of Eishes Yifas Tov. Is he allowed to have this relationship with her before she undergoes gerus? Rashi in Kiddushin seems to assume that the Torah didn't go that far and allow him to have a relationship. The Torah says that first she has to undergo a whole process. You remember that the Torah goes through the details, 30 days, and she cries for her parents, and she grows her nails, and she looks very unkempt. And then finally, after that period of time, if he still wants to, he's allowed to have a relationship with her, but that's only, says Rashi, after gerus. That's Rashi's unique shita in Kiddushin. Tosis completely reject Rashi. In this case, it's the Einikel who rejects the Zayda. Rabbeinu Tam argues with Rashi, and he says the following, that immediately during the course of the war, he's allowed to have this first intimacy with her, even before the gerus. That's called Bia Rishona, Bia Shnia. If he desires to continue to having a relationship with her, that's prohibited until after gerus. So the machlokas between Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam is the following. According to Rashi, even the very first Bia has to be postponed until after the gerus. According to Rabbeinu Tam, the first bia is permitted before the gerus, but no subsequent bia is permitted until after gerus. Now, it's going to be very important for us as we go through this Gemara. This is what we're about to embark upon, is the sugya of what's called Tamar and Amnon, who lechora were brother and sister, and yet they had this relationship. It's very important that we understand that David HaMelech took 400 women during the course of all his many battles as Eishes Yifas Tov. Now, assuming, like Tosfos, like Rabbeinu Tam, that the first bia was permissible even before gerus, then any child that David would father from any of these 400 Yifas Tov. Would be goyim. They would have to undergo gerus, because again, if the mother is a goya, then the child is a goy, and that's going to have tremendous implications in terms of Tamar, because Tamar's mother, although she underwent gerus, she was born as the daughter of David before the gerus. That makes sense according to Rabbeinu Tam. And therefore, she was not related to Amnon. The reason for that is that even though they were biologically related, but as far as the Torah law is concerned, Gershon is Gayer Kikot and Shinola Dami, which is a very fancy way of saying that no biological relations are legally binding or valid with regard to the Torah law in a case of a non-Jewish person. So keep that in mind as we go through. Now the Gemara is going to describe these 400 sons that David fathered, who were all born to Yifas Tovs. 400 of them. So the Yad Ramah says the following: Ha'ofen shebo yela Adam li Adam echad. He means one person. Arba meos yeladim Yifas Tov hu rachok ma'od. Okay, that's an understatement. Imagine how many battles did David go out to and you're going to tell me that he had a relationship with 400 women, all of whom were non-Jews, let's go according to Rabbeinu Tam, and hence he fathered 400 sons from these 400 ladies. He says, Harei sheyitol achas b'chol milchama, in every battle he would take one eishes yifas Torah, v'yavo leho, let's say, going to Rabbeinu Tam, konim giyurus, so bia achas bilvad. So he has in each battle one possibility of fathering a child with one bia, because only one bia is permissible as a yifas Torah. So the entire enterprise of a child of a yifas Torah, which means that he doesn't have a marriage relationship with her, right? Because again, the Gemara wants to justify that David HaMelech was only married to 18 wives, and the 400 Yifas Toras were beyond that number, because this was before Gerus, and that's not considered an Eishes Ish. Again, later on after Gerus, he can marry her. But we're talking about the 400 sons that were fathered by a Yifas Torah. So the Yad Ramah gives an answer. Again, I don't know if you'll be happy with this. Let's not get too excited. He says, "Ein lahamid es divrei haGemara el ba'ofen sheyotza liarbamios milchamos v'lokach b'shivya arbamios noshim yifas toar achas b'chol milchama." You're going to have to assume, says the Yad Ramah, that David HaMelech went out to battle 400 different milchamos, and in each milchama he took one yifas toar. Oh, he says, alternatively, if you like the second option better, I'm not so excited about the second option either, hayu masayim milchamos, David HaMelech only went out to battle 200 different wars, v'shava masayim yafos toar, V'yolda kol achas ti'omim. So he only had relationship with 200 yifas toars. Each one gave birth to twins. And all this happened b'giyusa, meaning before the geiros. And again, that's according to Rabbeinu Tam. V'tzarech lomar, the Yad Ramah has another proviso here, she'achar kach lo nisa'on, that he never married these women. Shim lokeh, because if you assume he married them, then riba b'minyan nashim hamutar eslo, right? The maximum cap was 18. Avol Rashi b'kiddushin, so let's understand another way of learning this Gemara. Maybe we'll be happier with Rashi. Rashi's not here, but in kiddushin. Arbamios yeladim elu hayu l'david b'chayalosav lo hayu banav. It doesn't mean that David fathered 400 sons, but rather chelosav, his soldiers, during the course of all these battles, the total number of yifas toars taken by all the soldiers in David's army was 400. Sheshavu Yisrael miyifas toar b'melchamos arbamios yiladim. The lo hayu banav klal. Now again, when you look at this Gemara, Rashi is a real stretch, because the Gemara says, "Amar Rabbi Yehuda Marav, arbamios yeladim hayu lo leDavid." It sounds like these were David's sons, but Rashi refuses to accept that. Maybe for the same reason the Yad Ramah was having so much trouble here. How could it possibly be that one man would have had 400 yifas toars, when each war requires, you know, maxes out at one yifas toar? How is he going to get 400 of them? And not only that, we're talking about a relationship which is a one-time relationship before the Gerus. So on one bia with an eishes yifas toar, multiplied by 400 to get 400 sons, very difficult. And that forced the Yad Ramah to explain that David HaMelech actually went out to 400 different battles. And in each battle he took one woman, or alternatively 200 women on 200 battles, and each one gave birth to twins. Rashi says, no, don't take this Gemara literally, but rather chelosav, his soldiers went out and took a sum total, of 400 Yifas Toars. V'lo hayu banav. So why does the Gemara call them banav? V'kulam b'nei. So here, other Mefarshim, the Rivash, say the following. Elohim b'nei beso, they were considered the household of David. David it provided them with all that was necessary to raise them. V'nisgadlu b'beso. And it's quite possible that he raised them in his own house. Again, I don't know how large of a house it would be. You know, they have today, you can visit the ancient castles, you know, palaces of the kings, you know, with, they'll tell you they have 1,400 rooms, you know. If you go to, for example, Vienna in Austria, you'll see, you know, what was her name? That's, anyway, she had a palace with so many hundreds of rooms. Anyway, he according to this Rivash, based on Rashi, David HaMelech raises 400 sons as if they were his own. Now, the Gemara tells us that these 400 young men played a very important role in the military campaigns of David HaMelech. Why? Because they were very strong and very scary looking. Megadlei Blorios. They wore, they shaved their head in a way that they had some sort of like a ponytail in the back. You know, these were the, what do they call them today? These kinds of, there's a colloquialism, you know. You know what I'm talking about? The skinheads kind of thing, you know, all these kind of very strange, they ride the motorcycles and they have strange haircuts. You know, a Jewish boy would not be allowed to wear this bloris. That would be a violation of Chukas HaGoyim. But David HaMelech allowed it for these boys because they weren't technically Jewish. And therefore they could be noy k'minyan minag HaGoyim. And they were very scary looking. V'kulam yoshvim b'krono shel zahav. He had them each get a carriage that was made of gold. That also indicates, you know, in the eyes of the enemy, very impressive. Umahalchim Baroshe Gaiso, saw you. They would go in front of all the soldiers, riding in these chariots, looking so scary. Vehemayu Balia Grofim. They had very strong fists, you know, physiques. Shall base David. And Rashi adds, not here but elsewhere, Rashi says, Shall you matilim ema al oivav. And they put the fear of the Lord in the hearts of their enemies. So they were the frontal thing. Now, were they part of the battle? Did they actually participate in the war? So the Gemara establishes in Kiddushin that they did not participate in the war because Ein lokhim b'nei chayel elam yuchasim. Elohai yotzim lahafchid es oyveihem. They were not actually part of the battle because you need a miyucha, somebody who has good, you know, good pedigree yichus in order to be part of the battle. Now, why were they so scary? And the Ben Yoyada, that's the Ben Ishchai, comes up with a whole new idea. The Gemara says they were scary because the way they looked and the way they rode these chariots and the way they were so physically, you know, strong looking, gigantic. But the Ben Yoyada says that the enemies knew that these guys were b'nei yifas toar. Now, a Yifas Toar could only be taken as a captive after you win the battle. So this is a way of, in a sense, of publicizing or projecting the image of the successful triumphs of David HaMelech in his battles. That's what scared the life out of the enemies. V'hoshivam b'krono shel zav, v'itiru lehem legadol blorios. And he says, according to the Ben Ish Chai, that these young men actually underwent gerus, which means that they could have actually participated in the battle, not the way we saw it earlier. Why did David allow them to wear these blorios, even though after gerus a Jew has to dress like a Jew? And the answer is because it was very important so that the spectator, meaning the enemy on the other side of the battlefield, would recognize them as B'nai Yifas Tor, that they were not Jewish. They were really the children of captives from the non-Jewish nations that David HaMelech had captured during the war. And they would recognize the success of David HaMelech. The Amar Rabbi Yehuda Marav. Now we get to the sugya for today. I mean, it's again a little bit late, but we'll see what we can accomplish in this sugya. So just to give you a little background, there's a fellow who's not such a nice guy by the name of Amnon, and he has a sister by the name of Tamar. Now when I say that Tamar is his sister, we have to know whether that's halachically so. But let's say biologically, she is a sister because they both have the same mother. And that mother is Macha. Just one second. Let me just see. Is Macha on the list of the six? Let's see. Does anybody remember if Macha was on that list?
Yeah, Shalom ben Macha.
Hashlishi Avshalom ben Macha. Okay, good. I see there's a note here on Macha. Let me just see if that's relevant to us. Oh, okay. So he writes in the note, Lehalan, later on, which is the Gemara we're about to learn now, Yisbaya will be, we clarified, She'eshes Yifas Tor Hoysa. So Macha was an Eshes Yifas Tor. And amongst the children of Macha were Amnon and Tamar. We'll see how that all pans out. Now again, I don't know how this sugya is going to fit according to Rashi, because Rashi says that Eishes Yifas Tor is only permissible after Geirus. But we're going with Rabbeinu Tam now.
But the same Gemara says that Amnon's mother was Ahinoam.
Okay, Majir, you're a little bit ahead of me. I'm sorry. I'm again, you know, I did this Gemara at about 3 in the morning, so let me just see if I can put it all together. So Mitch already knows all the answers to all my questions, but I'm going to ask him to hold on because it has to sink in here. Okay. So let's go slowly. Tamar bas yifas toar hoysa. So what we know now at this point is that Macha, the mother of Tamar, is an Eishes Yifas Tor. Shenemar. Now here, the Pasuk is going to record a conversation between Tamar and Amnon. Now, you may remember, or you may know that Amnon eventually rapes his own sister Tamar. And she tries to convince him, Tamar tries to convince Amnon to hold off. There's no need to do it in this illegitimate way. That he can actually marry her. Kedasu kedin. Viata daberna. I don't know, he has in parentheses the word al. Daberna hamelech. Excuse me for just one second. Just want to see if I... Oh, it's not going to find it right now, of course.
There's a question whether it's Al or L.
L with what? With an Aleph?
Yeah.
Oh, L. Oh, good.
Al Gemara says Al. And
okay, if it's Al, if it's L with an Aleph, that makes me happy. Okay. I'm not even going to bother looking it up here. It's, okay. In other words, Tamar is giving a piece of advice to Amnon, and if you want to, you desire me, then why not just tell the king that you want to marry me? He's going to allow you to marry me. So the Gemara asks the obvious question. I'm going to prove to you that Macha was a Eishes Yifas Tor, because if we're going to assume that Tamar was born in a full-fledged marriage relationship, from a full-fledged marriage relationship between Macha and David, that's called Bas Nesu'in Havi, then Achase Mihavi Sharyole. How could it be that Tamar, we'll soon see that Tamar was a great tzaddikus, how could she say to Amnon that we're allowed to get married? How could we be allowed to get married? Because if Tamar was born to Macha after Macha's gerus, that would mean that Amnon and Tamar were sister and brother.
She couldn't say that.
Just one second. This is a little bit confusing. Tamar Achos, I'm just going to read the footnote here. Tamar Achos Avshalom Bas Yifas Tor Hoiso Kodim Shiniz Gairo Macha Imo Yoldalo Ludovides Tamar Hoisa Etzlo Vitoras Yifas Tor. So now he's confusing me a little bit because he's telling me that Tamar was the sister of Avshalom. Just one second, because they both had the same father. Just one second. I'm just trying to get the. He should have drawn a diagram here for me. Okay. So Imlo Huchalom Chavnimtsa Shins Gaira Macha Kodim Shenasa David Tamar Haisachos Amnon. Okay. Just get this right here. So it says here that Avshalom was ben Macha. Avshalom was ben Macha. That would make Avshalom, if Macha was the mother of Tamar after the gerus, then Avshalom and Tamar would be full sister and brother. Okay. Now we get to Amnon. So where is Amnon in this picture? Amnon, how is Amnon the sister of Tamar? Is it because
of David?
Amnon is the son of David?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so if Amnon is the son of David, and if Tamar's gerus, I'm sorry, if Macha's gerus took place before Tamar was born, then that would make Tamar the sister of Amnon. So again, we'll see soon why Avshalom comes into the picture. But leaving out Avshalom for the time being, if we focus on the relationship, the halachic relationship between Tamar and Amnon, so the answer is that halachically they're not related. If, again, there's a big if here. If we assume that Tamar was born after the gerus of Macha, then Amnon and Tamar shared the same father. Is that correct?
Correct.
Do we know who Amnon's mother is?
Yeah, it's Ahinoam.
Oh, Ahinoam. Okay, so as far as the mother is concerned, there's no relationship between Amnon and Tamar. Amnon and Tamar, in the worst case scenario, would be paternal sister and brother, would be half sister and brother. But that's only if we assume that Tamar was born to Macha after the gerus. We're going now according to Rabbeinu Tam. And Rabbeinu Tam says that Eishes Fas Toar, you could have a relationship with her even Begiyuson, meaning even before the gerus, which would mean that Amnon and Tamar are not sister and brother. Hence we understand what she, Tamar, was claiming, what she said to Amnon, that if we would ask for permission for David to recognize, okay, I'm looking for a different word. Anyway, to sanction the marriage between us, then he would in fact sanction it. Why? Because we're saying that Tamar was born to her mother from David before the mother Macha had undergone gerus. And since Tamar was born to a non-Jewish mother, therefore she's not considered the daughter of David, and she's not considered the sister of Amnon. So far, so good. So now the Gemara says, in the name of Rabbi Yehuda, that when it says in the Pasuk, Uli Amnon Rea Ushmo Yonadav Ben Shima Achi David, V'Yonadav Ish Chacham. So Amnon has a bad friend, whose name is Yonadav. Okay, now Yonadav, it turns out, is David's nephew. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav, the Pasuk calls him an Ish Chacham. Don't be misled. Don't misunderstand. Ish Chacham Lirish'a. Normally a person uses his wisdom, his Chachma, for good things, for the right decisions. But here, this fellow Yonadav was very clever in a negative sense. And he's going to give an Eitzah to Amnon, how Amnon could rape his sister. Again, we're talking about his biological sister, Tamar. Vayomer, okay, so we'll fill in a few of the words here that are left out. Vayomer lo Yonadav li Amnon, madua ata kocha dal, why do you look so thin and so depressed? Ben HaMelech, you are the son of the king. And that evokes Amnon's response. Vayomer lo Amnon es Tamar ani ohev. Now I skipped a few words here. In the pasuk it says, es Tamar achos Avshalom ani ohev. So we don't have time to go into this, but basically Yonadav is going to give his friend Amnon an entire a whole setup here, in order to recommend and advise him how he could get to have this illegitimate relationship with Tamar. When I say illegitimate, meaning without her haskama, she only wanted to marry him, but not to have this relationship. Again, so a lot of questions we're going to have to ask. First of all, where does Avshalom fit into this picture? Secondly, what was Yonadav's advice? Why, we have to answer the question, why Amnon was not willing to accept Tamar's request to marry her, and David would sanction such a marriage. And then we'll have to answer the question why David, as we'll soon see tomorrow, Mitzvah, he actually participated in the whole setup, it seems. Didn't he realize what might happen as a result? And the final question we have to ask is that the Torah, the Tanakh, records that after this rape relationship, he, Amnon, hates Tamar. A minute ago he was passionately in love with her, and now he hates her, and we're going to have to see why. Okay then, Rabosai, so we'll stop here, and we'll finish this B'li Neder tomorrow.